I'm going to do my very best. I looked at what I wanted to say, and I pared it down and pared it down and pared it down. Forgive me if I haven't pared enough. Because there's just so much in it. It's the tip of the iceberg and then some. So, to begin, let me just ask a question. How many of you, at some time in your life, have you worn glasses, contact lenses, done something to your eyes in order to correct or do something corrective for your vision? How many of you? Okay. Is there anyone here who has not? All right. Go, Leslie. Let's give Leslie a hand. We wear devices like this for all sorts of purposes. These are reading glasses for me. I cannot imagine what my life would be like without these reading glasses, because without them, I can't read. I can't read. I can't imagine my life without reading. So they allow me to see things that they allow me to see better. Are there other reasons that you all can think of why we wear these corrective or use these corrective things besides seeing better? Or what does seeing better mean to you? Anyone have any ideas, thoughts? I hear focusing. They help us to focus. That's really wonderful, Sigrid. Any other thoughts? Because many things are obscured and the focus helps us. Go ahead. Communicate. How do they help us communicate, Elaine? Okay. Sure. All right. What else? What other ways? Yes. They protect the eye, certainly. Okay. Any other thoughts on that? And why am I talking about lenses when we're talking about Genesis chapter 1? Here's the reason. Because they do all those things that we just talked about. And what they all have to do with, they allow us in one way or another to allow this one sense that we have. And we are a vision-oriented world for the most part. Even though it's only one of our five senses, that's the one that we have focused a lot on. And it allows us to use this sense more effectively. It allows us to see things that without them we might not see. But those things, and this is what's most important, are always there. But they have become obscured. Or if you're a person that has some form of color blindness, how many of you have seen those tests where it's a circle of with all sorts of dots inside of it? And it shows you that if you have a color blindness to the color red, all you look at is a circle of a bunch of dots. And then they pass a red lens over, so now you can see the red in those dots. And there's a pattern that emerges, usually a number or something. That number was always there. The number was always there, but it was because the lens that we put on that allows us to see what was always there. And the reason I share this with you is I am convinced that Genesis chapter 1 can serve as exactly that for us, can serve as a lens to the rest of the Bible, a lens to our world, that if we put that lens on and we look at what it says to us, what it shows to us, we begin to view the world in a different way. We begin to read the Bible in a different way. And so let's, in fact, put our Genesis chapter 1 lenses on and let's see what is shown to us there. So in the very beginning, what we have in the very beginning, the very first lines, is it says that the earth was barren with no form of life. It was under a roaring ocean covered with darkness. And in case you're wondering, I just said I can't read without my glasses. I blow this up to 24 font, so I don't have to put my glasses on and off while I'm preaching. So I can't, it's still fuzzy to me. The earth was barren with no form of life. It was under a roaring ocean covered with darkness. For the ancients who were writing this 2,500 or so years ago, the ocean represented chaos and danger. I remember my aunt and uncle had a house on Kanielhi Bay, and they had a water skiing boat. And when we were kids, we were always invited to come and water ski. I remember water skiing in Kanielhi Bay the day after watching the movie Jaws. Da-dun, da-dun, da-dun. In the bay that is known to have tiger sharks, I can tell you, I understood what the ancient Hebrews were talking about here in terms of you don't know what's going on below you there and why it is so dangerous. And so what they are saying in the beginning is, in the beginning there is this world that is chaos, and then God speaks, and in God speaking, God is able to bring order to that chaos. Is able to bring order to it. That is the most important lesson they want us to know. If that is the thing that we view, the way that we view God, that God is a God in our lives that can bring order to the chaos of our lives. What a phenomenal lesson. When we go out to Camp Mukulaia, after you fill out the form that Sigrid has for you, at the end of September, and we go out there and we gather in the chapel and we look at the painting, Kuakeahu, the mural that is there, and you look right in the middle at the bottom, you'll see all this darkness, and it comes from the Hawaiian mythology of the understanding of the world of creation, of Po, where there is darkness. But if you look at it, it's not dark. It is, in fact, a mass of colors, a mass of vibrancy that is all on top of one another, and it is because of that, its unformedness, it looks dark. But in fact, it is. So just for a moment, close your eyes really tight. Now allow them to pop open. When they were really tight, was it just dark, 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 dark? There was all sorts of stuff popping inside your eyes, right? It's when you then open it, it comes into form. That's what's happening there in the very beginning of the Bible, is we have this darkness, this chaos that is coming, and God speaks, and out of it comes order and form. And for the ancients, when we lived in a world of powers and principalities that can control and oppress us, to believe in a God that could take that chaos and return it to an order where we can live in a life that is filled with love was very important. For the ancients, if we lived in a world in which we are slaves to our pride, to our ego, to our self-interest, and to know that God can impose or God can come into that life and with that life bring order, the order of transformational love into our life, that's really important. And so when we understand that from the very beginning, the lens we put on is a story that is going to emerge of a God who cares and loves so much, that from the chaos of our lives, there is order, there is love. And if you jump all the way to verse 27, and you see humankind is created in the image of God. The Hebrew word for image does not mean mirror image. It's a word that talks about resemblance. And most scholars look at that and say resemblance in terms of having traits that are similar. Well, if the primary trait of God is that God can create from chaos, order, should that then not be our primary trait as well? That we are looking to create, to work with, to go along with God in that process of a world that feels very chaotic and bring order to it. So that's the first thing that we see there. The second thing that we see in the Bible in these verses is just listen to the wonderful yin-yang of what is created in the various days. So we have light and dark, evening and morning, waters above, waters below, earth, seas, flora, fauna, sun and moon and stars, night, day, those of the sea, those of the air, those who roam, those who scurry, the four-pawed, the two-legged, male, female, creation, rest. In the yin-yang concept, all these things that we may look at as opposites and therefore oppositional are not oppositional. Rather, they work together, they fit together to make a whole. What God has created is a world of balance and harmony. And you have all these parts that are balanced one with the other. And you have this world of balance and harmony, and as we did with the papayas, every part of that world is connected together. No part that comes after can exist with what came before. And that which came before is dependent upon that which comes after. The wonderful mystic theologian Hildegard of Bingen talked about that which connects us, which is that which went from day one to day seven, and identified that which connects us is simply, I, the fiery life of divine wisdom, this is God. I ignite the beauty of the plains, I sparkle the waters, I burn in the sun and the moons and the stars. With wisdom, I order all rightly. So what we have is a world that is presented to us in that first chapter of Genesis that is filled with balance and harmony, that is filled with connectivity to one another, in which the presence of God swerves its way in and out and throughout. This is the world that we are created into. And if we live and put those lenses on our eyes, what a different world it is, because if we see that we are all connected to everything else that has been created, and that everything else that has been created has the spirit of the divine within it, if we see that, then it becomes practically impossible to treat anything as an other, as an object, because everything else is the presence of God, just as each of us are. So you have the eco-theology. Thomas Berry, who says that if we live in that way, we are able to say that the universe is a communion of subjects, not a collection of objects. So if we put those lenses on from the very first parts of the Bible and understand a world that is created with balance and harmony and interconnected, how does that change the way in which we live? How does that change the way in which we read the rest of the Bible? And then In verse 28, we have this amazing thing in which God says, and I give you dominion over everything else, over the earth. Problematic word for a whole lot of folks, because we think of dominion and we think of domination and we think of power and control. But here's the weird and funny thing about language. Language is always contextual. Words always have to be looked at. What do they exactly mean at the time in which they're being written? And sometimes what is written, we may mistake. So, for instance, the word in Hebrew that is translated as dominion has just two letters. And in Hebrew, the letters and the meaning of a word changes if you add dots to the bottom of the letter. So if the word has two dots, if the letter has two dots, the word may mean something than if it only has one dot. And there are scholars that have looked at this word, and they realize that the difference between the two-dot word and the one-dot word is one is translated as dominion, and the other is translated as to lower oneself to. So if you are given dominion, if you are given this Hebrew word, and it's actually the one-dot version in which you are lowering yourself to the earth that God has created, what a difference that might make in the way in which we relate to the earth. Now, it is not hard to imagine that since those scrolls have been copied for thousands and thousands of years, that the definitive copy that has the two dots translated as dominion may well have begun with one dot. No one knows, but let's just assume that it was always two dots. It isn't lower oneself. It is that word dominion. We have to look at where is dominion used in the Bible. And it's used in a number of different places, but only in one place. Only in one place does it get defined. And that place is in Psalm 72, in the Psalm of Praise for Solomon. Solomon, who was at his best, the ideal king. At his worst, he was far from ideal. But at his best, he was the ideal king. And Solomon is told to have dominion over everything from sea to sea. And this is what your dominion, the dominion of a king like Solomon, will look like. He will deliver the needy when they call, the poor and those who have no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight. And then in Ezekiel, throughout many of the prophets, Ezekiel is a perfect example, there are times in which God speaks and says, so y'all heard that in Psalm 72, you know what you're supposed to be like. And now I'm looking at you rulers, and I'm not so pleased with what's going on, because here's what the rulers look like in Ezekiel 34. You have not strengthened the weak. You have not healed the sick. You have not bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strayed. You have not sought the lost, but with force and harshness you have ruled them. So what we have is God is very clear that that understanding of dominion that we think of as domination is not at all what we want. The understanding of dominion, even the two-dot version of dominion, is one in which you look to there where there is need and you meet and you serve the need. So when we read and put the lenses of Genesis 1 on our eyeballs and look at the world through that, and we see that we are given dominion, and dominion is actually to look to where there is need and meet and serve the need, what a different world we might well live in. What a different way we might read the rest of the Bible. And then finally, what Matthew Fox, the theologian Matthew Fox, calls the original blessing. Did you notice that when the kids were reading with me, that the part that I had them read, at the end of every day, what did God say? It was good. It was good. At the end of every day, God says it was good. In fact, at the sixth day, God says it was not just good, it was very good. And sprinkled throughout, and particularly on day 5 and day 6, God doesn't just say it's good. God looks at all that has been created and offers a blessing, blesses it. So what Matthew Fox talks about is that what we have in chapter 1 and the first part of chapter 2 is a theology of original blessing, which means that everything that has been created is both good and blessed. Now contrast that with the theology that will be proclaimed in 90% of our churches around, at least in the developed world. And that is a theology that is called original sin. So you have original blessing, chapter 1 in Genesis, the lenses that we view the rest of the Bible through, that all are good and blessed. And then we have this theology that was developed that says, that's original sin, that says that Adam and Eve sinned, and since we are all therefore descended from Adam and Eve, every person from that point forward is born sinful. Not born with the possibility that they might sin, is born sinful. So we have everything is created good and blessed, everything is created full of sin. And this, the original blessing theology, we rarely hear. And yet, there it is in the very first chapter of the Bible that we will read. And if we start reading the Bible from chapter 1 of Genesis and put those lenses on, we can't help but then read the rest of the Bible in that way. But instead, if we allow ourselves to go to this theology of original sin, we come into all sorts of things that we theology that we now have as part of our milieu of the world. So there's this theology of eternal hell and the eternity in heaven that all comes from that theology of original sin, because God just can't stand sinfulness and therefore has to send us to a sinful place. In fact, today I walked into my office and there sitting in my box was something that a kind person dropped by and said, please make sure you read this carefully. This tract says, we love your soul and we want to tell you that if you have never been born again, you are on a journey to a place where you will burn forever and ever. And then it says, Adam sinned, all people are born with sin. If you have never been born again, you are spiritually dead toward God, just like Adam. If you continue in this condition until death takes you from this world, you will be eternally condemned to the lake of fire. So, how many of you have had that theology presented to you in your life? Okay? A lot, right? And that theology, in order to avoid that lake of fire, then requires us to adopt another theology, which is a theology of sacrifice, because God is apparently not happy unless something has been sacrificed. And since sin is so bad, therefore we need to sacrifice something. And the sacrifice we're going to do is we're going to take God's Son and we're going to sacrifice God's Son. This is called substitutionary atonement. And we're going to allow Jesus to die for our sins. So then, if we will just say the right prayer, we can be fine. This is the theology that emerges from that understanding of original sin, which I have to tell you is not the theology that exists in Genesis chapter 1. The theology that exists in Genesis chapter 1 is not that we are born sinful, but that we are born good. Not that we are born outside of God's blessing, but that we are born with God's blessing. What a different world we would live in if that is the way in which we view the world. But if we view the world in which we see everything as depraved and sinful, then it becomes easy again to make everything an other. And if we make everything else an other, then it's easy for us to just do what is right for ourselves. This tract that was given to me did not ask me to go and work for justice in the world, did not ask me to do anything. It merely said, say the right prayer so that you, the reader, can have your ticket punched to heaven. It's all about me. But original blessing is just the opposite. It's about understanding our connectivity to all. Imagine the policies that we would have in a world in which we operated from original blessings. Imagine what our environmental policies would look like. Imagine what our immigration policies would look like. Imagine what our foreign policy would look like if that is the world that we operated from, a place of original blessing, as opposed to a place in which we are convinced that all else is sinful. But if we just say the right words, we'll be fine. And since we're fine, we don't have to worry about anyone else. So, Genesis chapter 1 is a set of lenses that gives us a chance to see the world in a different way, to see that which may have been obscured but has always been there, to see that which was out of focus and that we can put it into focus, that God, our God, loves us enough that in the chaos of our lives can create order and bring love. And God, our God, creates in us a resemblance to God and calls us to such, to live in a world balanced and harmonious and to create that world, to work to make it happen, to where there is hurt and there is need, to serve that hurt and that need. And to always find ourselves working our way back to that original blessing. Back to that place where we can recognize that all is indeed good, that all is indeed blessed. If those are our lenses, what a wonderful world. What a wonderful world we would live in. What a wonderful world indeed we can live in, because that is the world, not imaginary, but the world that God has called us to. Amen.